All right, grab your Bibles and open them up to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. We will be finishing our series on the fruit of the Spirit today. We've been looking at all of this, all of these traits that God has given us, given His people to pursue, promising us that the Spirit will work in us and cultivate this fruit as we go. And so we make the effort and God does the work. That's what we've been looking at now for the last 9 weeks. The final fruit here is self-control. Now, at the outset of this series, I said that the first three, love, joy, and peace, are sort of the outcome of practicing the rest. In other words, if you are patient and kind and good and gentle and have self-control, you will in the end produce love and joy and peace. And so these first three are sort of overarching fruit that the others more specifically define for us. Now, as we get to the last one, we sort of have the opposite of that. That is, self-control is the fruit that is required in order to have any of the others. It is the fruit that is involved in bringing about every other fruit. And this is because putting to death the passions of the flesh and replacing them with the desires of the Spirit requires self-control. Let me show you what I mean. It begins with the recognition that something needs to change. Right, in order to take on the process of spiritual maturity, you must first admit that yourself needs to be controlled. Now, this is the exact opposite of what we are usually told in our society today. What the Bible tells us is that human beings are sinful, that we have turned away from God, and that we need to change and come back into alignment with Him. And so the great problem of humanity is that we have fallen short of our created purpose. We have turned away from God and we are now dead to the truth. Now, what we hear from the world around us is, you are just fine the way you are. And so we define love as people who accept you just the way you are. Joy is people allowing you to sort of seek fulfillment in the way that you believe is best. And peace is people kind of getting out of the way so that you can realize your reality. And self-control has no place in that worldview. The idea of self-control flies in the face of a society that thinks that it is good as it is. Self-control is the declaration that the self needs to be controlled. That on its own, left to its natural instincts, the self will go awry. So self-control presupposes that there is a problem that needs to be fixed. With this, it also assumes that the self does not have the tools to do this fixing. Biblical self-control is different than just being self-willed, in that controlling the self requires an outside source to provide the truth. If we are going to control our emotions and our behaviors, then we need something beyond ourselves. Because our self is the source that has created the problems in the first place. If we're going to fix those problems, we need something else. And so to control them, to submit them to an alternative, requires finding something that is truer and better than our natural self. So self-control requires admitting a problem and finding a standard outside of ourselves to conform our lives to. It also needs a reason. Right? Why should we change and what is the purpose that we are working towards? If we are going to decide not to follow our instincts and do what comes easiest, it's going to be because we have a greater purpose that we are striving towards. And so as we have been working our way through the fruit of the Spirit, we have been applying this kind of three-part metric to each of them. First, what are the ways in which we are not living this out? Right? Why aren't we loving and joyful and full of peace? Second, what are the examples or what is the model that the Bible gives us to conform ourselves to? What is the better way? And third, why should we do this? What does it benefit us to live in God's way? And so in a sense, we've been talking about self-control throughout this entire series, but now we get a chance to look at it directly, to define and defend self-control on its own. And to do that, we're going to look at Paul's defense of his ministry in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. So starting in verse 19, this is what it says. It says, "For though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all, that I may win more of them. To the Jews I became as a Jew in order to win the Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law I became as one outside the law, not being outside of the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings." Now, this is a pretty well-known text, and it usually comes up in the discussion of evangelism, specifically in regards to contextualization, right? The idea of we need to shape our message to the people that we are speaking to. Paul becomes all things to all people so that he might save some. In the same way, then, we should think about how to apply the message of the gospel to the people that we are specifically speaking to. And so the main thing that people usually take out of this text is a willingness to adapt your gospel presentation to the audience. Again, that's usually how I have heard it described and presented, which is not a bad idea. We absolutely should be contextualizing our message. But that's not completely what Paul is talking about here. See, if you go back in this letter just a little bit, you see that chapter 8 is about using your freedom to serve others. It's the whole section about not causing your brother to sin. The idea here is that you have a freedom in the gospel, specifically when it comes to eating food sacrificed to idols. And so Paul's argument is, idols aren't real, and food is food, so no big deal. Eat the food, don't worry about it. It does not pollute you, it's not a sin. But then he goes, but it's not actually that simple. Because it is going to be a big deal to some Christians. Some of them have been raised to believe that the gods are present in this food that has been sacrificed to them. That there's sort of a power in eating this meat. And now that these people have converted to Christianity, the idea of participating in this pagan worship is sort of disgusting to them. It's really hard for them to understand how other Christians could be doing this, and it would affect their growth to participate. And so Paul says they have a weak conscience. Now, when he uses the word conscience here, he's referring to their understanding of the freedom of the gospel. What he's saying is they're still bound to sinful practices that they have been part of. To them, eating meat is still wrong. And to simply ignore that and partake, to just sort of go along with the crowd, would actually harm their process of sanctification. So Paul is saying the solution is not to say those weaker Christians should just grow up and get with it. No, they actually should honor the process of the Spirit applying the truth to them. And we should help them with this. Now, Paul's not talking to the person with the weak conscience here. He's talking to the more mature believer. And what he says to the more mature believer is, part of what you need to think about is how exercising your freedom is going to affect others. If doing what is allowable is going to cause harm to the faith of another person, you should refrain. This is how he says it. He says, "But take care that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak." And so while eating this meat sacrificed to idols is within your rights, it becomes a problem when it causes harm to the faith of another. Now, this is much like that conversation about bearing one another's burdens we talked about last week. Paul is saying that those who know Christ should be willing to suspend their rights in order to serve those who are less mature in the faith. But as he goes on, he even gets a little harsher with his language. He says, this isn't just what is best, but if you are causing another person to sin, this actually lumps you into the category of sinner. This is what he says in verse 8. He says, "And so by your knowledge, this weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. Thus, sinning against your brother and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. So acting against their weak conscience leads them to sin, and ultimately then it makes you a sinner as well in the process. Now again, before you go, whoa, that's putting quite a bit. Paul is talking to mature believers. So he's talking to people who have already claimed, I am a sinner. They've already taken on that identity. So he's not calling someone out and being like, hey, you who doesn't know that you're a sinner, you're a sinner. He's going, you already know you're a sinner. But let me help you to see some of the ways that that sin is causing problems. And so he declares, I myself am willing to give up the right to eat meat if it helps build up the faith of another. In all of this, we see that self-control is not just about yourself. It's about how you should control yourself in order to serve the less mature in the faith. Now, before we jump ahead into chapter 9, I want to point out an area where this applies today. Because most of us are not worried about whether or not our meat has been sacrificed to idols, unless you're really concerned with GMOs. That might be... Anyway, right? That's actually a whole other conversation. But one of the areas where Christianity has really been beat up over the last few years is on the topic of modesty. Yes, I'm going there. Last week, I read from 1 Peter chapter 3, and it talks specifically about this. Now, let me be clear. When I'm talking about modesty, I'm talking about the conversations about how women dress and whether or not it's anyone's business but theirs. Now, the consensus, I read a lot of blogs this week. The consensus from the blogosphere is the church should shut up when it comes to what women wear. Now, I think there's two reasons why that is now the common answer. The first has to do with how we see our responsibilities to one another. That's to say, if we're all autonomous individuals with rights and responsibilities, if this world is every person for themselves, then I cannot be held responsible for your struggles and your sin, and you can't tell me what to do. Within that framework, the whole conversation about modesty becomes about who's at fault and the corresponding guilt and shame. That's where an answer like women should not be held responsible for the fact that men struggle with lust, right? That's usually how this is now framed. It's not about what women wear. It's the men who have a problem. Okay, I agree with that, right? Men do have a problem with lust. It's why the Bible specifically addresses the sin of lust and tells men that they need to work on this sin. But think about how different that response that I just stated sounds from what Paul has been telling us here about how we treat those around us. Paul makes no argument that the weaker brother isn't weaker. It's like in their name. They are the weaker brother. They're the ones who struggle. They're the ones who aren't as mature. But what he says is, recognizing this weakness, you should set aside your rights to encourage their faith. In other words, do you have a freedom to wear what you want? Yes. Within reason. But the question should not end with what can I do? What am I allowed to do? What's within my rights? Right? We should ask, how does it serve those around me? Now, by the way, part of the reason why I chose this issue is because it's been maddening for me to watch people sort of swing all the way over on the other side of the pendulum over the last couple years. But the same thing applies to 100 different issues, right? Men, the way that you sort of flirt and lead women on happens all the time. I'm just being a nice guy. No, you're not. Oftentimes, you're actually leading a woman into sin. Coarse language and joking, you can argue, oh, swearing's not, whatever. How you use it matters. Alcohol, are you looking out for those who are in addiction and struggle? Are you even thinking about this? Is the struggle of others even within the framework of what you care about? Because if what you're saying is, they should be more mature and I can do what I want, you're not actually living out what the gospel calls us to. There are things that you are free to do that are not beneficial to those around you. And those who are self-controlled should be directing their lives towards what will build up their love for Christ and the love of Christ from those around them. Which leads me to the second reason why modesty has become such a negative conversation topic to many Christians. And that is that the call to be modest in the church was not just given to the spiritually mature, but it was sort of forced on everyone. What I mean is, this is calling mature people to live in a mature way, and oftentimes what the church did instead was imposed a legalism on everyone, including those with a weak conscience. And so those who should have been given grace, had people serving them patiently, were hit over the head with the legalism of modesty. So, and when I say legalism, I mean legalism. Like, if we're talking about length of skirts and measuring things of such sort, that is in the category of legalism. I never want to be a church that has the legalism of modesty. I also don't want to be a pastor who is asked to go around with a ruler. And I don't want that because it is damaging to the faith and to a person's understanding of the gospel. That said, we should be a church that sees self-control as part of what it means to grow in the faith. We should be willing, like Paul, to give up what may hinder another person from experiencing the absolute freedom of the gospel. We should consider how our choices are affecting others. And that's ultimately what this section is about. Paul's identity, that which drives his life, is the gospel. And his main concern in everything that he does is not for Paul, but God's glory. He says it, I do it all. I do it all for the sake of the gospel that I may share with them in its blessings. And because the gospel is his anchoring point, all other identities and rights submit. And so it isn't just that Paul is willing to become a Jew to the Jews and one under the law to those under the law. It's that the gospel of Jesus Christ is his purpose. Showing the goodness of God's love for his people is more important to Paul than his personal identity. And so he's willing to kind of get rid of whatever is going to get in the way of that. And so the reason for his self-control is the glory of God. And it's a powerful motivation that pushes him beyond just sort of getting rid of the bad things from his life. He's even willing to set down what is rightfully his if it's going to help others in their relationship with Jesus. So this is the first part of self-control. Your motivation must come from the gospel. Your reason for conforming your life and pushing back against your desires must be an act of worship to God. Because any other reason of trying to fix yourself and make things right is going to unintentionally lead to legalism and or despair. But it's only when you see your life through the lens of service to God that your own personal identity does not get in the way. Now, once that reason has been set, once you have the right motivation, the question is, what does it look like? Paul offers us a metaphor here in verse 24. He says, "Do you not know that in the race all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable." So the example that Paul uses for us is of an athlete, which is a metaphor that he actually uses throughout a lot of his epistles. He'll talk about athletes quite a bit. And he uses this metaphor in different ways, so we need to be careful to make sure we understand how he's using it here. The first thing he says is that there's only one winner in a race, which is a really strange thing to say when you're talking about the Christian life. Right? Try to be better than all the other Christians out there, because there's only one winner. That's not what he's saying. Instead, he's encouraging us not to be complacent in how we pursue righteousness. In other words, we shouldn't try to find the bare minimum level of what it means to be a Christian and sort of just hang out there. A lot of Christians do this. Rather than asking the question, what would most glorify God? They ask, how much can I get away with before I disqualify myself? And once I find that line, I'll do a little more than that. To live this way is to misunderstand how destructive sin is. To try to sort of maintain as many as your sinful desires as you can, believing that you can kind of control what is best, it's going to get you in trouble. Instead of trusting in God's way to conform you, his standard being the driving force behind self-control, you try to manage your own salvation. Instead of letting God control you, you end up trying to sort of appease him. God, I'll give you enough. Just get off my case. Let me do what I want to do. I'll give you this little bit. In this, God ends up in opposition, or you see God in opposition to your desires. What God demands and what you want are in tension. You end up always in a fight with God. Along with this, when you have this mindset, grace ends up getting really twisted. I've seen this happen a lot. Grace ends up becoming an enabler for apathetic Christianity. See, if you're asking the question, how much can I get away with before I have sinned too much? Grace says what? Grace says God's mercy is more powerful than any sin. You can't sin your way out of God's grace. Now, if you're trying to figure out how little you can do, you go, whoa, then I can do whatever I want. God has to save me because he's gracious. God will cover it all. And so grace, read through the lens of minimalist Christianity, becomes actually an excuse to sin. Now, the best defense against this falsehood is not to become brilliant and figure everything out. It is simply to do what Paul says here. Run to win. Don't play with this idea of having a lukewarm spiritual life and thinking that's going to get you to the end. Do everything that you can to pursue God. Make his righteousness your goal. Discipline yourself to achieve it. And so he points us to the athlete. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. Now, a person who competes, an athlete who is truly like high-level competition, they organize their life around getting better. Right? Their diet, their schedule, their sleep patterns, their exercise. They're actually hiring guys now to manage all of these things for them because every part of their life is about getting better. They got to beat the other guy. And no one questions this. No one sits there and goes, man, well, I shouldn't use Lance Armstrong as an example. Woo! That's what came to mind. Right? No one looks at like a high-performance athlete and goes, they should have tried less. No, man, it's justified. They made it. They did it. All of it seems worth it if they can achieve their goal. And so Paul says, how much more should we be willing to discipline ourselves to obtain an eternal reward? If exercise and discipline make sense for someone who aims at winning an athletic competition, the same rigorous self-control should be part of the Christian life. For those who strive to make it through this life following God to the end, we must be self-controlled. And Paul describes this moment at the end in 2 Timothy chapter 4. He says, I've fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Henceforth, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. To make it to this point, where you stand before Jesus and he says, well done, good and faithful servant, you cannot merely aim for the bare minimum. It requires making him the focus and the aim continually. Prioritizing the things of God over the things of this life again and again and again. This is where self-control comes in. Self-control is the means by which we run the race. Self-control is setting up the habits of our lives to pursue God. It's making sure that our daily habits are bringing us back into our relationship with Him over and over. Because habits form our hearts. And in the same way that exercise forms the muscles of an athlete, practicing the godly habits builds the Christian up to be able to stand against all that aim to draw us away. What aims to draw us away? The flesh, the world, and the devil. And if we take these threats seriously, we will prepare for them. Your life will be organized to strengthen you by connecting you more deeply to the hope of the gospel. And if that's what you want, the alternative is not an option. That's where Paul goes, verse 26. He says, "So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified." Paul says, I am self-controlled because I know what the alternative is. The alternative is disqualification. By this he means, when we are the ones in control, we will be overwhelmed by sin. You can't handle it. We're not able to walk the line playing with sin and thinking that we will come out unscathed. Running aimlessly leads to failure. And so the encouragement is to make self-control a priority in your life. I would say every week we come here, every week we come here and we pray, lead us not into temptation. But that prayer makes no sense if we then walk into temptation willingly. Right? The other side of that prayer is putting the structure in your life to avoid the temptation. Of course, we do that not by cloistering ourselves away. We don't hide from the world. No, we develop habits of self-control that create the discipline and strength to stand firm. So I want to finish this sermon and this series with three areas of self-control that we should have in our lives. Three areas we should be thinking about. Am I self-controlled, or what do I need to do to start kind of putting the things in place so that I can discipline my body to keep it under control? The first is in worship, what I would call spiritual rhythms. Self-control begins by putting some anchoring points in. There need to be some habits in your life that all the other parts build around. And these pillars help shape you and become the structure that, again, everything else is organized around. Let me give you a few spiritual anchoring points that are important for a healthy self-discipline. None of these are going to be a huge surprise to you. First one is this, church attendance. This is always, whenever I talk about going to church and I'm preaching in the church, I'm like, preaching to the choir. You're the ones who are here. You're the ones who have decided to be here, so really this needs to be said to the people who aren't here, but this is what I got to work with, right? Gathering together weekly with God's people works on numerous different levels to bring God's truth to bear on your life. Right? When we come here together, God's truth is preached, his sacraments are shared, his people confess their sin together, we're built up to live his purposes out in community. As a weekly rhythm, this keeps bringing us back to him. This is a forming rhythm that is very important in our busy lives. Second one, again, not a huge surprise, prayer. Now, when I say prayer, I'm not talking about necessarily being a prayer warrior and spending prolonged periods of time laying prostrate on the floor. You might get there. That's a good goal. But what I mean is establishing a regular pattern of bringing your concerns to God. Just a regular rhythm. Maybe it's when you get up in the morning, on your commute, at a meal, when tucking the kids in at night. Figure out what works for your schedule, but make it consistent. Make it over and over. When Paul says pray continuously, he does not mean that you do nothing but pray. He means you interact with God on a consistent basis. You're constantly bringing your issues to him and laying them at his feet, trusting that he will do something with them. Third spiritual rhythm is Bible reading. Look, I know the Bible can be hard. I know it takes work. I know there's times when you get into a minor prophet. By the way, we're starting Habakkuk next week. Minor prophet? That's not a joke. We really are. There's times when you're in those areas and you're going like, what does this even mean? How do I even make sense of this? keep going back to it. Because the Bible is the way that God challenges us. It's the way that he shows us who he is. It's the way that he gives us the truth that we are to control our lives by. And to kind of set that aside as like, well, that's for some people, not for me. I don't learn that way. You're basically starving yourself of the means by which God communicates to his people. In order to control the self, we need God speaking into our lives. And the Bible is the way that he does this. So regularly listening to him through his word is how God directs us, how we know who he is, how we know what it is he wants us to do. Now the reason why these are the places where we must start is because these three habits are going to help determine sort of what all the other habits are. Often what we do is we have kind of this set schedule and then we're like, oh, I got to add prayer in. But the kids have this and I, you know. Instead of going, we start with God's rhythms and we build up from that. Now, that might mean that some things that right now are good things get pushed out. It might mean you don't have time for things that you like. A little aside, I always say this, we have eternity. It's all right to like miss out on some things in this moment. If we have eternity, you can hike later. There'll be plenty of kayaking in heaven. Those, don't worry about what you are sacrificing in this life. You have plenty of time. That was a side note, sorry. Here's the thing, if we don't go to God for this liturgy, if we don't allow him to form us, the culture is going to fill in the gaps. And so the first part of our self-control is setting up rhythms to our lives that are regularly putting us face-to-face with God, that are regularly challenging us with who he is, reminding us that we were created in the image of God, and it is he who we are being conformed to. Second rhythm is schedule, or practical rhythms. It builds right out from that, right? Each and every one of us only has 24 hours in a day, 7 days a week, in which to get everything done. As I said before, there's lots of good things to do in this life. There is no person who can do all the good things that are offered. You have to figure out a way to say yes to some things and no to other things. And the way to do that is to, again, build up from the source, to allow the question of what would bring God glory to be what helps you to answer yes or no. Ultimately, the way we set our schedule is based on what we're running for. We don't want to be people who run aimlessly or box as one beating the air. And if we're going to get to the end of this life and go like, yeah, I actually ran the race, I used my time, we're going to have to intentionally schedule to accomplish the work of the gospel. Self-control is not allowing our sinful desires to drive us, but instead allowing God's truth and God's purposes to become what we live out. It's to not allow the concerns of this earth to be our metric. A person who is self-controlled is one who connects themselves to what God says is ultimate and then makes this the purpose of their lives. Too many Christians are living out what's called syncretism, which is trying to balance sort of the cares of the world and sort of blend it with God. It doesn't work. It's never worked. People have been trying it for a really long time. One always will win out. And most of the time, because we are surrounded by the world, it's the loudest. And so Jesus warned us. He said, no one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. Really, you could fit a lot of other things in where money is there. Time, energy. Our schedule is set by what and whom we serve. But it also has the ability to form what we love. In other words, self-control is choosing the things that you know are right, trusting that God will help your desires follow your habits. Now, this works into our third area of self-control, and that is morality or ethical rhythms. Too many Christians run God's commands through their own filter, trying to make God make sense to them. And they take what is pure and good, and they look at it through a depraved lens, and often decide, God's wrong. Self-control means conforming ourselves to His good. It means making what He says not only the measure for our good, but what we discipline ourselves to be. Instead of asking God to make sense to us, we say, I guess we do want God to make sense to us, but instead of trying to fit it into our little understood world, we ask God to change us, to help us to see the world in the way that He has created it to be. And as you take on God's order, it's amazing. It's amazing. It all fits together. When you allow His definitions to actually run what is true and good, things actually fall into place. And so instead of every ethical issue being a detached question that must be answered individually by study and research, it's all connected. It all comes back to the goodness of God. And so a question like the one that we mentioned earlier about modesty, it cannot be detached from the effects of the fall and our responsibility to others and how we see ourselves as people created for God's glory. Living for God's way helps us to see that there are so many levels of interconnectedness when it comes to how we live our lives. Every decision that we make has massive implications to a lot of other people. Now, in a sense, that really complicates morality, doesn't it? Because it's almost like any conclusion that we come up with is going to be somewhat wrong, because we have no way to take into account the layered nature of the created order. Of course, on the other side, it makes things much simpler, because it reminds us that we don't have to. This world is not about us creating a truth or blazing our own trail. This life is about us living in obedience to God, being self-controlled and allowing His truth to work its way through us. Because the best that we're going to conclude apart from God will always be sinful. When we realize that, we can take His law and morality as a gift that protects us from the effects of sin and helps us to bless those around us. As we saw in the reading of the law, it guards us. So self-control is acting out God's good even when it doesn't align with how we think the world works. We simply trust Him. And we trust that through living a self-controlled life, He will help us to see what is good as the Spirit shapes us in line with it. And so we come here every week to organize our worship and our schedule and our morality around God. And every week we come here, we take communion, which declares, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And so as you come to the table today, come asking Jesus to control you, helping you to be a disciplined person who allows the things of God to order your life. Let's pray. God, we thank You so much for creating us as people who are limited. And while that is not always something that I am thankful for, I know myself well enough to know that I would simply go off on my own and think that I was fine if it weren't for that continual reminder of what I can't do. And so thank You so much for creating us in such a way that life is hard, that we decay, that ultimately that we are faced with our limitedness. But God, in that, help us not to despair. Help us not to look for solutions to that aren't from You. Help us not to decide that good is impossible because it is difficult. Instead, help us to see Your plan and Your good as You originally created us. Help us to strive for the righteousness that You have presented to us in Your word. And help us as we go along the way and as we fail and as we trip up and as we mess these fruit up trying to cultivate them. God, remind us over and over again that you are with us. That our efforts aren't enough, but you're there to use even our failures for our good and for your glory. We thank you so much for all you do, especially for Jesus. It's in his name we pray. Amen.